Future Friday. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Future Friday with Hamish Hallett and John Beasy. And we have another subject to speak about, looking into the future of this. So we're going to look into today about communications and encryption, or encryption communications. So as you may think of this subject, it'll sound very, very daunting and very futuristic. But me and John will try and dive into this subject. So what is encryption communications? Or what would you say communications is, John? What would you say?
Well, communications is, well, the transmission of information between two or more participants. And encrypted communications is just the encryption, the coding of these of this information, so it can't be interpreted or understood and useful to outside actors. And while it may sound pretty futuristic, it's something that we do on a regular basis a lot.
Yeah, that's actually very true, actually, because I was kind of looking into that, the fact that more of our workforces are sharing information. So I was looking into one article, something about five reasons why you need encrypted file sharing, where 26% of organizations are sharing data daily and 44% share continuously data. So in that sense, it does show the fact that, more organizations are sharing information. So definitely having encryption for that is very, very much needed, especially for information not to be hacked and stuff like that. And it definitely shows that encryption is needed. So I think it's very interesting, the fact that organizations are now turning towards encryption more and more.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of things have been encrypted. There's different kinds of encryption, but whenever you pretty much sign into most websites, if you notice, a lot of websites will start with HTTPS, which is the hypertext something protocol, but the S makes it secure. That's an encrypted connection between your computer and the server you're accessing, versus an open connection, which is just regular HTTP. So that in itself is a kind of, that's encrypted communication.
And is there kind of like other forms of encryption, or would you say is that the one main form of encryption?
So when you're communicating, there's two main ways you can, just two different models for encryption. There's server-side encryption and there's end-to-end encryption. So server-side encryption is where the information you send to the server gets encrypted at the server side, or rather the communication to that server is secure, but it may be encrypted on the server there, or may not be stored in an encrypted format on that server. So that's how something like, say, Facebook Messenger works, where other people can't look into your communications on Facebook, but Facebook still can, because it's Facebook that's doing the encrypting. While end-to-end encryption is where the encryption, the encrypting and decrypting happens on the local device. So that's something how, say, WhatsApp works, where before you send the message, and before it gets transmitted, it gets encrypted, then gets sent over and gets decrypted on the recipient's device. So that means, when that's a generally more secure form of encryption, because no one besides the intended recipient has access to that information, not even the server itself. So you always got to be wary about when companies say, we have encryption, it's secure, we respect your privacy, because while it is encrypted, it's not encrypted the same for everyone.
And the fact that, especially for, like, let's say a company is quite suspicious of you, they can easily encrypt your messages and look into it, especially how they kind of sometimes deem suspicious, quote unquote. That's a very, like, let's say, questionable term, let's just say that. So, you know, those companies could easily encrypt your information even though you've done nothing wrong. And that definitely causes a little bit of a slight, like, a rights issue, like a right to privacy and things like that. I know there's some of these kind of, do you think like laws, like protection of data comes into this as well? Because I know the EU had done a General Data Protection Regulation Act, which went into force on the 25th of May, 2018. Does those kind of things like help stop that kind of things? Or are we still liable to these companies being able to have our data still?
Well, those are generally more about how these kinds of, what kinds of information these kinds of companies can collect, rather than trying to regulate how these companies communicate with each other. But to give you a different perspective, I would say private companies might be the least of your concerns in terms of who gets access to your information. Because it's not just the companies that have access to that information. You have pretty much any, if you have any information stored with Google, with Facebook, with Microsoft, or pretty much any other major technology company that's based in the United States, the United States government through the NSA and the PRISM program has access to that information. And so does GCHQ, Government Communications Headquarters in the United Kingdom. That they actually collect more data and more internet traffic than the NSA does.
Really? Didn't know that.
Oh yeah.
That's really bad. I don't know.
They've tapped the fiber optic cables fiber optic cables that connect Europe to the United States and North America pass through the United Kingdom. So the UK has tapped those, and basically all the internet traffic that goes through there that isn't encrypted, and they'll have collect and analyze.
And what's even interesting now is I've been seeing a lot of these kind of like apps that try and, you know, find ways to transfer data and things like that. So for example, there's like Firefox Pro or something like that can send files over, which is quite interesting.
Firefox Send.
Sorry?
I think it's called Firefox Send or something.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. So like you have all these kind of different apps that send across all this kind of information now. And it's the fact that now it's not just, you know, what you mentioned, organizations like the NSA or, you know, governments that can have encryption, but also people ourselves can also have these encryptions as well. So things like we'll talk a little bit more a bit later about like TOR, which is all around the dark web and stuff like that. But before going on to that kind of subject, how do you think, how has kind of encryption evolved over time, do you feel? Like how has it kind of improved to be more powerful? Has it improved to become, you know, how has it kind of evolved, would you say?
I'm not an expert in the history of cryptography, but I would, cryptography, that's maps. I'm not an expert in cryptography, but I would say it's historically been a kind of cat and mouse game within terms of privacy advocates and governments. Because the big thing is, say for example, the FBI has asked Apple to create backdoors into their encryption to give them the keys to decrypt encrypted iPhones, because they believed a suspected terrorist had information on his phone, which Apple refused to do because Apple didn't want to compromise the privacy of their devices. And then the FBI just revealed that they hacked it anyway. You can have that, or it's, you know, all the different kinds of measures people take to try to combat making sure they have their own, they have control over over their own information and who has eyes over it. So it's, you know, people try to do one thing and other people will try to, you know, break that system or decrypt it, and you have to keep trying to do it all over again. That's why you have to see a lot of, that's why you have to pay attention to what kind of encryption you're using. Because again, if you're using something like server-side encryption, or pretty much anything besides end-to-end encryption, your information's liable to be compromised by by private actors or the government. It's not just whether or not you have to trust where that data is being stored, but you also have to trust that it's not just the companies and the employees of that company who trust with that data. We also have to trust that they're not going to give that data to anyone else, and they're not going to be forced to under law. Absolutely. So you also have to trust the government in which they're physically located.
And it's the fact that it's the fact we need to kind of sort certain laws in place that kind of can help have these kind of things in place that, you know, that there is some form of trust at least for your data not to be taken away and used in a certain way. But what's quite interesting actually, because you're kind of mentioning about kind of data being used and things like that. I don't know if you've seen, but you know, with like South Korea and their way of dealing with the coronavirus, I don't know if this is completely true or not, but they were talking about how South Korea kind of used or tracked people to help contain the virus. I don't know if it was South Korea, but I was hearing stuff around a country.
Do you want to go into that? They've been tracking cell phone location data. They basically, you know, use that to track the locations and past location history of people who were, you know, who've been tested positive of the virus, and they would send mass texts saying things like, okay, an old lady between, you know, 60 and 65 in this area was tested positive. Click this link to see the list, to see a map of where she's been the last few days to see whether you've been there yourself.
That's quite interesting, actually. Would you say that's, I don't want to say that's good or a bad thing, but you could argue it's like a double-edged sword, because in one way, South Korea trying to find a way to kind of help contain the virus. Obviously, it's got data, it can track people to help contain the virus, but at the same time, it's a bit suspicious because they have your data and they can track you. So it's like, how, in that case, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know. It's quite difficult to tell.
Yeah, it's definitely... it's definitely tricky in that it's, I mean, South Korea has definitely handled it so far very, very well compared to other countries. So on the one hand, you can make the argument that it is effective and it is useful. On the other hand, it is a violation of these people's privacies, and it is concerning about how, you know, how this information gets handled. Because on the other hand, it's, you know, when emergency legislation gets passed, that kind of stuff usually gets breeze through without a lot of oversight. So something that might work well in an emergency situation, you might have to revisit afterwards to rein things back once things normalize, to make sure you're not overextending or giving too much power to a government. But you can also take a look at, say, how countries in Europe are handling it, because they have to comply with the GDPR. So the Italy is also collecting cell phone data, but it's collecting it anonymized and on aggregate. So it can't track where individual people are, but it can see, it can't know who the individual carriers are, but it can see where people are moving.
That's fair enough. Because yeah, I think it needs to find a way to kind of maneuver past that kind of act. Because I was even like, I don't know who is saying this, but some people were trying to say like, oh, we should look at I think it was like for Americans were like, oh, we should look at South Korea and how they've dealt with it. And it was a bit like, well, hold on, they've done this. Would actually Americans even agree with this? Or even Canadians, or even anyone really, making that more broadly. So it's interesting because it gives you that debate about, you know, do we allow states, do we allow, you know, let's make it more like state related. Do we allow states in times of crisis to have access to our data, you know, through encryption, through all these kind of things, you know, in times of crisis, do we allow that? Maybe we do, maybe we don't, you know, it's a very big question. Cause I was just wondering that's all about your kind of opinion.
Well,
on
the
that.
Other question, the other point is, I think it's not a matter of whether or not we allow it to have that. I mean, yes, we should be asking that question, but on the other hand, it's also a matter of whether or not they already have access to that and whether or not they're collecting it and using it openly. Because again, you know, the UK and US governments have been collecting this information for a decade at least. But whether it's a matter of whether or not and how that information gets used. They have access to it, whether or not they're actually using it for dealing with the virus in a responsible way or for anything else besides certain conceptions of state security. Yet they, you know, it's what kind of oversight they have over it.
Mm. No, exactly. And the fact that, loads of citizens, organizations just share so much information on the web. It's the fact that so much is out there that can literally be taken forward and, well, taken advantage by the states. Like, even though states say that we're not using your data is protected, you never know. They might be looking into this data. But
it's about your data is protected. The question is protected from who?
Mm, no, exactly.
That's like all the data's on Facebook. Yeah, it's protected. People, unless you can hack into Facebook servers, you're not going to have access to it. But it's not protected from Facebook itself and anyone Facebook chooses to share that with, or anyone Facebook's coerced to share it with.
Mm. No, exactly. It's like your example with the FBI and Apple stuff. Yeah, exactly. Definitely is suspicious. So then moving from that, what is TOR? So if people don't understand what TOR is, it's the Onion. Sorry, do you know what it is? Sorry, it's the Onion.
TOR stands for the Onion Router.
The Onion router, yes.
Yeah, so how it works is it's, I'm not an expert, but basically it's a way to browse the internet in a more anonymous way by rerouting and encrypting the information you have or the information you're trying to access. So say, for example, what I mentioned about the fiber optic cables, if you have physical access to those cables, you can then see what kind of information gets getting transmitted, where it's going to and from. So you can see, okay, there's communications from Russia going to the United States. What's going on there? What's happening with that? How TOR would work is it obfuscates that by taking, say, you're trying to access a server in some other country, that instead of it going from the necessary nodes to your computer, it will then say it starts on a server in, I don't know, France, and then it goes to another server in Russia. It's encrypted and sent to a server in Russia, then it gets sent to another server in Sudan, and it gets sent all over the world thousands of times, encrypted, before it gets sent to you. And so it's like each layer of encryption is like a skin onion.
Clever. Very, very clever.
So it allows you to access the same kind of internet that you see, just through a different way. It hides who's accessing it from where, but it can't hide whether or not you access, it can't hide whether or not you're using Tor to access it. So like, you can access Wikipedia on Tor, but you can't edit it without special permission.
Mm. I feel like they're kind of doing this as a way of kind of communicating more securely and anonymously. Would you say it's kind of helping without kind of government interference? Because I was just reading something about a beginner's guide to this. And it said that it's a way of kind of using this to communicate more securely or use sources more securely. And this is without any government interference. So this is pretty much, is that kind of true pretty much? Is there a way of government intervening into this, or is it completely under this sort of dark web, would you say?
Well, most major news outlets are accessible through Tor and have special drop boxes for whistleblowers to access through Tor. So it is a way to communicate without any kind of government oversight on what's activities happening on the network. So you can communicate the information you might need to communicate. that comes with a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, you could have bad actors using that. On the other hand, it allows people the oversight to actually be able to speak truth to power and speak out about their information they wouldn't be able to disclose otherwise.
And would you say this is kind of used by like people who are in non-democratic governments or even democratic governments? Do you think it doesn't really matter what kind of regime they are in? Does like everyone really use it?
I mean, yeah, you can access the Guardian through Tor. Like most people in the West use it all the time. That's how they get all governments have their skeletons in the closet and no government wants to let those out. There will always be ones trying to control of information. It's just a matter of how much information they allow to flow. So yeah, you see people use it all the time in Western states to, you know, hide from the US and UK governments and their oversight. The Anglo-American states have quite a surveillance hegemony over the rest of the world.
And could also the government use this as well, though? That's the thing, because, you know, not just the people. I feel like looking into this, it's not just the people themselves that can use it, but also the government also use it to even find out information they don't. It's like they could, if they want to know some sort of information about a certain regime that they don't particularly agree with, they could use it as well. And that's quite scary as well, isn't it?
Sorry, can you elaborate that point?
Sorry, so what I meant was, it's like, let's say you have one state that wants to know certain information from another state that, let's say, they disagree with. So let's say it's the US wanted to know information about Iran. Let's just say that, to give two examples. And, you know, the US wants to know certain information about Iran. Could they use this software pretty easily to try and understand some of Iran's secrets? Could that be possible pretty much through this?
I don't think so. I'm not sure. So all Tor does is obfuscate the location of who's accessing it. It doesn't really, you know, give you access to new kinds of stuff. So it's like people accessing servers located in Iran, yeah, they won't know they won't know that people from the United States are accessing them, but, you know, it's not like it'll give them access to more information than they would have been able to otherwise. You know, they still have to, you know, say log in or whatever. It's not like just because you're using the Tor browser to access Iranian servers doesn't mean that those servers aren't, you know, encrypted or aren't don't have their own access. It doesn't give you special access to things. It's just a way to browse without people knowing where you're from and where you're trying to go.
Okay, sure, fair enough. And do you, okay, that's understandable.
So it's like, it's not really useful for, like, I'm sure there are ways that governments could use it. They might be able to use it for, say, things like, I don't know, if they want to do something malicious, like the hide locations of any kinds of misinformation campaigns they're trying to, bots or trolls are trying to, you know, spread. It could be useful in that regard, but it's largely used to hide where you're coming from. So if the government is the one who's monitoring the internet, the government generally doesn't need to hide from itself unless it's doing something nefarious.
Fair enough. Okay, cool. Then I understand that then. Would you say, are there kind of like limitations then to TOR? Like, are there some things that it just can't do, would you say? Or, yeah, what kind of limitations are there for this?
I don't know if I'm familiar enough with its capabilities to evaluate that. But I would say that my understanding of it, it is largely just a way to hide the information of what kind of server you're accessing and where you're accessing it from. I would say that would probably be the limits of what it can do.
Okay.
That's to my knowledge. I'm sure there's plenty of other ways that people are using it, but I'm not familiar enough with it.
Sure. That's fair enough. Yeah, that's understandable. So it's more just a way of, you know, whistleblowers pretty much keeping their information, like, well, it's not keeping their information, but keeping where they are from hidden, and being able to find things that, you know, certain other governments might want to keep hidden. You know, it's a way of accessing that information rather than trying to find new information. It's trying to find information that is hidden. That's what I'm kind of getting at, it seems.
It can be hidden. It's hidden in the sense that it's not indexed. So it's not like Google goes and it's not like there's an onion equivalent of Google, because all Google does is looks at a bunch of public facing websites and tries to categorize and in a logical way. There isn't something that does that in Onion. So you kind of have to, you have to know the exact URL of the page you're trying to access. If you get it wrong, there's no Google trying to correct and figure out where you're going instead. There is like a start page that you open up that kind of says, has a links to a bunch of different kinds of Tor websites and different portals, but it's not like Google. It's kind of like an older, age of the internet in that kind of regard, where you had to know what you're trying to access in particular without trying to have anything to search it through.
Hmm. Okay.
Which is useful, which can be useful for, for whistleblowers or whatever, but it's also, this is the kind of stuff that people usually think of when they think of the dark web, is because that's how you can access a lot of, that's where the Silk Road, which used to be, a platform on the dark web where you could basically, order hard drugs on the internet and pay it through cryptocurrencies, before that got shut down. That's so you can access those kinds of things, or the other, the scarier parts of the internet can be accessed that way.
Of course. And kind of things like conspiracy theories as well. But actually, could conspiracy theories be accessed as well?
It's if anything that anyone wants to put up there. I saw plenty, you go on the homepage for Tor and there's, some useful, and you can see for yourself if you install the browser, you can see the homepage and you'll see some ones that'll be like, okay, yeah, there's some more innocent ones, Wikipedia, news sites. I don't know if you could access YouTube through Tor, but normal things. And then there were ones like, hey, you want to buy stolen credit card numbers? And then, there was also other ones where it's just like, oh yeah, here's, did you know the FEMA's got the reptilians and the little gray people when they're, they planned X, Y, and Z incidents because, they got to hide the knowledge of the grays.
Mm. Wow. So it's kind of like, it can be quite dark. It can be as dark as it wants to be, really. It can be as innocent or as kind of scary. I was actually thinking in my head, actually. I don't know if you've seen the news recently about this whole 5G conspiracy theory. I don't know if you've seen this. Does this relate at all to this, or is that completely me going off another tangent? I don't know. Would you say that is?
I would say it's kind of tangential. I'm not sure how the connection is, because I understand the whole conspiracy theory is that, the radio waves of 5G signals are bad for your health and compromise you against the coronavirus or whatever, which makes no sense.
Really? Okay, because that's the thing. Because I was actually going to read into it a bit more, but now that's, I found that out.
Yeah, no, it was about it wasn't about like, it wasn't about how any kind of communication on 5G. It was about the technology itself. It was about the radio waves.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, it was talking about how, because 5G runs at a different frequencies than 4G, so it is you know, it is different, but it's not a remarkably different band of the electromagnetic spectrum. It's not like gamma rays or whatever.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
They're still radio waves.
Of course. Yeah, it's like this whole kind of conversation about like, oh, if you hold your mobile phone for too long, you're going to get cancer and stuff. It's like all that kind of stuff. But no, that's fair enough. Yeah, because I just wanted to just understand what that was. Okay, fair enough. If it doesn't like completely relate to this. But as my last kind of sort of my question, before we go into like weak signals, what does the future hold for, you know, encryption communications? Like what can we look ahead for this? Like, do you know anything? What do you think will look happen really?
It's kind of hard to tell. It's on the one hand, you do see a lot of people, you know, lashing back at their governments and at Facebook and at these corporations for the poor mismanaging of their information. I would say if we want to have a proper, you know, a good proper internet where we can, you know, where we have agency and control over our own data, encrypt, having proper servers, end-to-end encryption, and you know, encrypting our devices themselves, encrypting as much as we can, that's going to play a big role in, you know, ensuring that there's privacy by design, that things get are designed in such a way so there is no compromise. You know, the whoever's offering the platforms, they have zero knowledge of whatever's going on. So it's just a matter of, you know, is that the kinds of things that people are going to demand and what they're going to use? Or will we going to have, you know, those kinds of things? Or is this what with back doors or whatever? Or, you know, it's our information's protected, but not protected from everyone. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to tell. It's that game of cat and mouse where people are always trying to find different ways to protect themselves. And then, but there are always people that are trying to find ways to compromise and exploit those holes.
Of course. And the fact that more industries as well are becoming more digitalized, I think that will then mean more encryption is needed as well. So for example, like robotic automation, you know, let's link this back to like our last week episode about construction. The fact that more robotics are coming into that industry in particular, they will definitely need more encryption because they don't want those robotics to be, I don't know, let's say, you know, from an outsider taken over, for example, you know. So it's like the fact that more automation is now coming in, encryption is increasing now, do you say?
Yeah, I mean, encrypted services have been increasing for a while. I mean, web browsers made HTTPS standard years ago. You get announced now, whether, I don't know if you've ever accessed a site where, the, you know, get a big white, yellow screen says, oh no, this, we can't verify the security certificate of this website. We're not going to go forward with it unless you really click a bunch of buttons to insist that it lets you go through, because sometimes the website just, you know, the certificate expired or whatever, so it's not up to date. But other times, you know, it's protected against spoofing or, you know, to make sure that you're going to the actual server you're supposed to go to. So, yeah, no, it's something that that's been going on for a while. It's just a matter of whether or not, you know, how far much farther we go with it.
Mm. No, definitely. And maybe like, we never know, like what encryption might go even further, even deeper, even stronger, potentially, to keep data even more protected, which means citizens might have their data more and more protected, but at the same time, government data might be more and more protected, which means whistleblowing cases might not occur as much. So that could happen easily. Well, I don't know. Would you say or no?
Well, whistleblowers are by the people who have access to that information anyway. They're the insiders. It's like,
The
information is going to be encrypted anyway. It's not about like people who go out and say, hey, I can see into government files and say that something's wrong. It's whistleblowers are like, hey, I'm an employee of this, of the, you know, the government, and I have something, and I'm seeing that there's something wrong with how we're doing things.
Okay. Yeah. That's true. Actually, that's more of a whistleblower. But then, okay, what about, yeah, that's fair enough.
I would say the other thing about the future is probably would be the advent of, say, quantum computing, if we could ever get that. That would definitely have to, that would be a real game changer for encryption, because a lot of it is, when you encrypt something, you essentially do a special math function to change, to basically recode all the information. And so you can brute force it but through sheer calculations, but conventional computers would take them years, decades, potentially even centuries for them to like go through all the math to do it. But quantum computers, because of how they work and because of superposition and quantum entanglement, you can essentially do all those calculations all at once. Once you have one, when you know the position of one electron, you know the position of all the other electrons. So it's those kinds of calculations could be, you know, solved almost instantaneously. So you'd have to find, you know, methods of quantum encryption to protect against quantum computers.
It's
that kind of cat and mouse.
Of course. Yeah. So it depends on who's gonna be the cat and who's gonna be the mouse. You know. So that's gonna be very interesting to see in the future. But that was a really good discussion about encryption and communications around it. So then let's go to our weak signal. So do you wanna go first or should I go first?
Go ahead.
Cool. So my weak signal is about, I know this is quite like a story that had happened kind of like ages ago, I would say, but Policy Horizons did do a piece on this. So it's around like Orwellian or not corrupted editions of Orwell's text sold online. So have a little bit of a look to this. So it's pretty much what happened was George Orwell's works, so things like 1984 and, you know, lots of his kind of work had actually got corrupted and actually got sold to lots of people. So there were some like errors of production, but there were some ideas of trying to change the intent of the novels to how it would be framed and things like that. So this kind of weak signal is just trying to show like a new way of misinformation, the fact that it can change texts that were already, that were established, to change the meaning behind it and really kind of create this misinformation in a very quite a big serious way, actually, to adjust it to kind of suit a certain agenda. And this can even mean now government work could easily be adjusted as well, if this happens as well. So it's not just with George Orwell text that could get adjusted, it could be other texts. So John, what do you think about this?
I mean, that's very Orwellian in the sense that very much the kind of stuff that happens in 1984. So seeing that happening in real life, you know, that's the fact that his character was, he worked for the Ministry of Truth, and he had to always revise the newspapers and all the history books to always say, you know, whoever we're at currently at war with, we're at war with Eurasia, we're at war with Oceania, we've always been at war with Eurasia. And then, you know, erasing people who were never, you know, been unpersoned or what was in the book?
Yeah, I can't remember the exact saying, but I know what you mean. Like, you know, trying to say like certain information is supporting our particular agenda, our particular government against another government or something.
Or it's another thing that he said in the book was, he who controls the past controls the present. He who controls the present controls the past. He who controls the present controls the past. He who controls the past controls the future, or something like that.
It's pretty much controlling whatever. It's like controlling the...
Once you can construct history, you can construct whatever you want. You can have something totally debased and abstracted from reality.
Completely. And I actually want to try and link this with another thing that has recently happened. I don't know if you know about this story. So Extinction Rebellion, which is an environmental organization. So they So, for example, some posters were put out in the UK and was posted by a part of Extinction. It was like a branch of the organization up in the Midlands. And it was basically saying, like, coronavirus is the cure to the humans, which are like the coronavirus is like a disease. Sorry, it's the cure. Sorry, no, getting that mixed up. Coronavirus is the
cure to the human disease.
That was it, yeah. So I don't know if you've seen this. And it kind of shows, like, and then there was this kind of ongoing battle. Like, they came out and said, this is misinformation. This was by far right impersonation. You could argue it is, might not even be it. But yeah, it kind of shows that if it is impersonation, it shows in that way, it's like misinformation is changing the intent of an actual group to be of this kind. So that was interesting to see. I don't know if you saw that story.
No, I hadn't. I hadn't heard it.
But yeah, it was something very kind of quite scary. That was happening. That happened in the UK.
So, wait. So what's the issue that they're wondering that it's that's not the actual position of Extinction Rebellion, but rather someone impersonating them?
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, that's it. Sorry, I didn't explain that too well. So yeah, pretty much the group. There were some leaflets out which said Extinction Rebellion, but apparently it's not actually them. It's an impersonation of them. That's what they are saying.
Oh, I mean, yeah. I mean,
yeah. So yeah, but at the same time,
that's age old.
Yeah, it's quite dodgy. Mm. But at the same time,
I don't know a lot about the Extinction Rebellion, so I would not be surprised if there are environmental groups that do have that as a legitimate position.
This is the thing, yeah. That's what I was questioning as well, because I was kind of like, well, hold on. How can you prove this is misinformation? How can you prove this is from a far-right group? Because there might be some environmentalists who are generally like this. Because Extinction Rebellion, by the way, have just to let you know, they are very radical people, like exceedingly radical. They go beyond. This is like more of a personal opinion. This is not, take it with a pinch of salt. The Extinction Rebellion, I think what I've been hearing apparently is like they kind of go beyond the environmental message, to go beyond like taking down, you know, capitalism, taking down democracy. I think I've hearing some stuff around that. The leaders has said a few dodgy ideas as well. So, you know, I think this group, you know, always treads along the line of being maybe a bit risque, probably. A lot of people, I don't know, it's suspicious, but yeah, these posters were very quite worrying if it is actually from them. But yeah, like what you said, I wouldn't be surprised if there are general people here who are part of the environmental group or part of the environmental movement that have these views. So yeah, so it just shows maybe it's misinformation, so maybe it's not. It's, yeah. So what is your weak signal, John?
I got one about an open source driving AI. So at the Consumer Electronics Show earlier this January, back when people could still go outside, they debuted an aftermarket add-on for cars that can add self-driving capabilities. So it's only for certain models, usually ones that are released in the last 10 years or so that have kind of you know, usually have kind of, you know, smarter cruise control and other kinds of features. So it's more of kind of like, it's more of an assistant driving system. So you still need supervision and intervention, and it's not quite fully autonomous. But the thing about it is the fact that it's open source. So that means that it's anyone can access the code, anyone can see the code, and anyone can change the code as they wish. So on the one hand, it can be really great, because that's something that, say, it can be provide a framework for, say, municipalities to build up their own kind of autonomous public transportation systems without having to, say, contract out that kind of stuff and be at the whim of whoever owns the proprietary code for whatever the driving system is. So like, say, Uber or Google or whatever, you know, if Google made changes to their systems, then you're kind of stuck with it. You don't get you don't have as much control. So it can be great in that way, but on the other hand, and it can be good in the sense that it can also be demonstrate that dumb cars could be retrofitted as smarter cars. So maybe you just have to, you know, add on some sensors to, you know, your old 2009 Honda Civic, and now you can, you know, drive it more smartly. But there are all the problems with open source software is that because anyone can change it, it could cause problems when, say, when self-driving cars become better regulated by law. Because, say, for example, there are a lot of moral gray areas in self-driving cars. You know, do we prioritize the life of the passenger? Do we prioritize the life of, say, pedestrians? You know, do you draw, you know, if there's something you have to swerve, do you swerve into oncoming traffic? Do you swerve onto the sidewalk, where you have to make a lot of these kinds of decisions? So if those things ever get regulated by law, if you have open source aftermarket products, anyone can change. People can theoretically change the code to something that doesn't fit in with those regulations.
Yeah, no, that does sound very interesting, because I think autonomous cars and things like that are definitely going to be part of the future. It's always like an ongoing conversation with, you know, the efficiency, the ethics of it as well. It's always going on about it. But I think it's interesting the fact that there is this software that you can just literally copy and paste it into an actual original model, which I think that's quite good. Because in that sense, it stops us having to build autonomous cars, where you can just literally get your software and then put it in these cars and just do it that way. That's good. But I do know what you mean in the sense of, you know, the fact that anyone can access it. Maybe there needs to be a way to kind of limit it to who can actually access it, you know?
So well, that's the thing with open source software is once it's out there, it's out there. You can't close.
Mm.
You can't close it again. You can't, if someone's out there, if someone's forked it, and has their own copy of it, it's out there. You can't, it's like anything you put on the internet. Once it's out there, once it's copied once, you have no control over it. So, that's on the one hand, it's kind of the beauty of open source software is that it's not dependent on individual people. It's just kind of, it's out there. It has its own independent existence that anyone can, you know, can contribute to and participate in. On the other hand, it's like if it's something that you want to control and something you maybe don't want people to have access to, maybe some very dangerous pieces of software could be made open source and freely distributed, and that could be harmful.
I was thinking actually. Well, I was about to say, yeah, like what if this software could then not just be put on cars, but could put on like other things like drones, for example, helicopters, missiles, all these kind of things. Like that's another question.
Missiles will probably want something different, but yeah, it can definitely, that's the nice thing about open source as well is anyone can change it to work for whatever, it can adapt it to work for their needs. So it could work for things beyond cars, and it could, yeah, it could definitely be used that in those ways.
But yeah, definitely have to. That's a really good weak signal, and a lot of questions again raised about that. Definitely, but this is a really good conversation. Just about, you know, encryption communications, but also about our weak signals, which is really good. So definitely a good episode of Future Friday. So yeah, hope you guys enjoyed that episode of Future Friday. You can listen to our episodes on Spotify, also Apple Podcasts as well. And hope you guys enjoyed and see you next week. Thank you very much.